I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast.
Welcome back. On today's episode, we're interviewing Dr. Bill Stoops. Dr. Stoops is the Associate Director for Clinical Science in the Substance Use Priority Research Area, and a professor in the Departments of Behavioral Science, Psychiatry, and Psychology, and in the Center for Drug and Alcohol Research at the University of Kentucky. Today, Dr. Stoops is going to talk to us about cocaine, pharmacological effects, some policy-level implications, in addition to prevalence and treatments for cocaine use disorder. Really excited for this one. Hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the show. We're really excited to have you. You know, big fan of your work. As we talked a little bit off air, you know, just really think of you as just a tremendous professional in our field. And so we're so excited to have you on. We usually start our conversations talking a little bit about people's training history, and it helps, you know, contextualize a little bit about, you know, their expertise and kind of understanding their journey a little bit, which our listeners tend to really enjoy. And so we're wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your training history.
Sure. So first, thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure. I am a fan of the podcast and am honored to be part of it. My training history, maybe we'll begin at the beginning. I went to a little school called Davidson College in North Carolina, where I was a psychology major. And I was actually going to go to law school because I wasn't sure what else I would do. But I took a behavioral pharmacology class and was just fascinated by the idea that you could apply science to the study of drugs, right? Of central acting drugs, because there's so much sort of hype around what they do, but you can actually apply science to understand them. And I did work with rats in college and learned very quickly that working with rats was not my forte, but knew that I wanted to go on and do get a PhD in psychology, in behavioral pharmacology. So the University of Kentucky was kind enough to let me in to graduate school. It was one of the few places in the country where you could actually study drugs in people and get a graduate degree doing so. So I got my PhD at the University of Kentucky working with Craig Rush. My graduate work was really focused on prescription stimulants. I then did a postdoc with Sharon Walsh. She came to UK right as I was finishing up, and I had wanted to work with her anyway. And so it was my good fortune that she came to UK from Hopkins, did opioid work with Sharon. And then Sharon and Craig offered me the opportunity to stay in a research title position here at UK. And then I transitioned to a regular title series and have been fortunate to rise up the ranks. I think I neglected to say that my background is in experimental psychology. So my PhD is actually in experimental psychology with a focus on behavioral neuroscience and psychopharmacology, and then postdoctoral training in behavioral science. But the theme in my career is behavioral pharmacology, largely in humans, but I do have a little bit of preclinical rat research in my background too.
Really happy to be talking to you today. And although you do, your work really does span the whole gamut. We're going to focus today a little bit on cocaine and cocaine use disorder. A lot of the work that you've done in that area, also just talking about the epidemiology, what it is, what's going on, are there treatments for it? So I'm personally thrilled to be talking to you about this today. But first, maybe let's just hear a little bit about what got you into that area of research?
Oh, I think that's a really good question. I'm not sure I have a great answer. I did that work in graduate school on prescription stimulants, looking at methylphenidate, looking at deamphetamine. If we're talking pharmacologically, methylphenidate and cocaine are very similar. Mm. I then went and did opioid work during my postdoc. But my early grant funding really was around cocaine, and that maybe a lesson for graduate students and trainees, early career folks is, write about what you're interested in, write about what your training is about, mm-hmm. Seek grant funding for that. And I wrote grant funding for opioids and for cocaine, but the cocaine work is what hit. My first R01 was opioid focused, but my first grant funding was really cocaine focused. Mm-hmm. And I just, then that's what continued to be funded, the really cocaine focused work. So I think that more than anything is sort of, you do what you're funded to do. Hopefully you're writing about what you're interested in, which of course I am interested in cocaine, but I was just as interested in opioids and I had done work on that, but I don't know, maybe study sections liked the cocaine work I was proposing, I guess.
Yeah. Funding priorities play a big role in that type of thing, right?
They do. And, you know, I mean, UK is a unique place, and maybe we'll talk about this a little more, but, you know, it's a place where we can actually study drugs of abuse. I don't have a better term for that. I don't like using that term, but that's sort of psychoactive drugs in people in a controlled environment, right? We have this capacity to do this work. Mm. And so I'm able to study cocaine in human beings, unlike really a lot of places. And so I think yeah. that also goes to, you know,
yeah.
funders recognize that we can do that work here.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, I remember when I moved to Colorado, somebody I know was talking about, you know, there are these interesting effects that happen from just geographic, like regional or institution level things, where it's like, you know, do the work that only you can do where you are now. Right. And so, you know, like in Colorado, it was cannabis at the time. And, you know, at UK, you know, these, you know, stimulant types of psychoactive drug studies are like, if I'm interested in, you know, the behavioral pharmacology of cocaine, I'm going to come across a UK paper, right? You know,
probably that's yeah. probably true.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And like you said, not very many people get to do that type of work where there's actually some self-administration. And so it's really special. We're hearing from one of the foremost experts in this. So excited about it. So, you know, we thought maybe we could learn just a little bit at first about like sort of the basics, you know, pharmacologic. So for a couple of, you know, simpletons like Noah and I, if you can try to teach it on the, you know, second grade level.
I'll try to keep it as surface as I can. You know, pull me back if I get too in the weeds.
I can ask questions. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Please do. So cocaine is an alkaloid from a naturally occurring plant, the coca plant, which is native to South and Central America. Pharmacologically, when someone takes it, and people can take it orally, they can inject it, they can snort it, it can be smoked. Produces relatively rapid action in the brain, and it works in the brain monoamine system. So we've all got these, you know, these neurons in our brain that release monoamines. So that's dopamine, that's serotonin, that's norepinephrine. What cocaine does is actually prevents the reuptake of those chemicals in the brain. So basically, you know, in a normal day, normally functioning people have dopamine and serotonin and norepinephrine being released in their brain all the times. And there's sort of a physiological level of that happening. What cocaine does is you have that physiological level amplified because our neurons, which are meant to pull those back into the, you know, into the cell so that they aren't acting, cocaine prevents that action. So it is, you know, it's keeping that dopamine, that sort of serotonin, that norepinephrine in the synapse, producing its effects longer. Cocaine also actually has an interesting effect in that it is a local anesthetic. So it's used clinically in eye and nose surgery because it blocks sodium channels and produces local anesthesia. And unlike a lot of other local anesthetics, it's a vasoconstrictor. So it also cuts down on bleeding. So a surgeon will use it for eye and nose surgery these days, which I think blows a lot of people's minds that cocaine actually has a therapeutic indication.
Yeah, I think we do forget, because you're just reminding me that it's not Schedule One.
It's Schedule Two, right?
Which is wild. It's therapeutically. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
It's not wild that it's not Schedule One. It's wild that it's not compared to other drugs that are Schedule One.
Right. Yeah. No, let's talk about Schedule. Right. Schedule One drugs. Yeah. We're talking about cannabis, right? Like, is a Schedule One drug. And again, I joke, none of this research is easy, but I joke that it's actually easier to do research with cocaine than it is with cannabis.
Wow.
This is a really great point, actually. I met with the lawyers for CSU yesterday to talk about getting DEA Schedule One license eligibility for the university so that we could do cannabis administration trials on campus. And it's like a whole thing. Right. But like that wouldn't be the case for cocaine, right? Just the pharmacy at the hospital could pick it up.
That's right. That's right? Exactly right. You know, it's provided by the NIDA drug supply very graciously provides it. But yeah, we are able to do it. We have a bunch of regulations we've got to follow, right?
Certainly.
Tell the FDA we're doing it. We've got it, you know, we've got our physicians have to, you know, prescribe it for research purposes, absolutely, all that kind of stuff. And it's a very controlled drug, but cannabis is a whole other level. I was actually on the Hill this week with the Kentucky delegation talking about, you know, what can we do to put research exemptions in place? Because, right, you can walk into a store, depending on the state that you're in, and buy Delta 9 THC, Delta 8 THC.
Right.
Right? But to research it takes years to get the license. It's incredible.
But the opposite is true for cocaine, right? Like you couldn't just go pick it up at the store.
I cannot. Right? I can't.
But you don't need a DEA license per se, like a Schedule One style.
Yeah. You don't need a Schedule One license, research on it,
right?
Exactly.
That's our workaround, right? Is we have people go pick it up at the store, and then we have a mobile laboratory that pulls up in a van.
That's cool. That's innovative. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's innovative. And also, you know, there's a host of issues related around it that make it, you know, challenging, right? Whereas bringing it into a controlled laboratory setting on campus with the appropriate safeguards and all that stuff would be just so much better from a science perspective,
right?
From a health human safety perspective. Right. And also, you know, that's what's necessary for the work to kind of move forward. And so it's, you know, it's a really great, thing that UK and yourself have been able to do this work, which I think has really helped us understand a great deal about what's going on with cocaine specifically and other stimulants of a similar kind, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a rare episode where we don't end up talking about the problems around cannabis regulation and research. So.
It's been a minute.
Yeah. So I'm not taking us too far afield. Here.
No.
This is very typical land for us to traverse during an episode.
But you were talking about local anesthetic, and then also, you know, maybe a little bit. Could you tell us a little bit about like the drug effects? Like, what would someone who is using cocaine, what would they experience?
Right. So I mean, you know, and I think there's a lot of myths around cocaine, right? Like, you know, we've got this whole cocaine bear movie that's happened, right?
The
bear eats cocaine and kills a bunch of people. I don't think that's actually what happened in the real story, but let's talk about what happens when we give people doses of cocaine in the lab, and then this sort of will tell you what happens in the natural environment. So when you give somebody an acute dose of cocaine, if you do intravenous dosing or smoke dosing or intranasal dosing, there's timing differences, but you see relatively rapid increases in heart rate and blood pressure. You see individuals report very positive subjective effects, right? There's a euphoria, there's a rush, they like the drug effect, you know, fairly positive drug effects. You might, depending, you know, it's subtle, you might see some performance enhancing effects, although that's not as reliable as, you know, as some might believe, right? But you can see it, right? Especially if somebody's tired and they take cocaine, you know, that's going to improve their performance.
Yeah.
Cocaine is very short acting, actually. You know, it's much shorter acting than a lot of the other stimulants, certainly more than methamphetamine, than D-amphetamine. Its half-life is about 45 minutes. So when we dose somebody, the effects are really offset, certainly by about an hour and a half after we've dosed them, which is not true with an amphetamine.
No, that's much more like 12 hours or 10 hours, depending on the dose and the person. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that, you know, positive euphoric effects. Obviously, that's, are there people like, is this, do you typically do these studies in populations that have used cocaine before? Or do you ever use it in drug naive? Do people ever actually report like negative? Because I imagine like there is this, you know, the heart racing, like it could almost feel like anxiety, right? Yeah. So I was wondering if you ever have people report negative.
Yeah. So we do the convention in the field, and it's a very good one. And so is that you don't expose people typically to drugs that they haven't used before. There are exceptions, you know, for certain drugs, but for cocaine, we are never going to give a dose of cocaine to somebody who we do not know who's actively using it and who also we know is not seeking treatment. right? So we do a lot of screening with the folks who come into the lab, make sure that they're healthy enough for us to dose them. Now, they're using on their own, and that's a different story, but we certainly don't want to dose them if they aren't.
Yeah.
Right. If they've had a myocardial infarction or they've had a stroke, right. We're not going to put that
right.
of our cocaine.
Good set of conventions. Right. Yeah.
I mean, really, really a good reason, right. We know the Belmont principles. We hold ourselves to a higher standard, right.
Exactly.
So nobody that we're testing is naive. They like this drug. They use it. I mean, many of them have a complicated relationship with it, right. They like it, but they hate it at the same time.
Yeah.
Any drug, any centrally acting drug that people are using to get high or that they like the effect, there's a balance there, right? Like you use too much and it's anxiety provoking, right? It's anxiogenic. It produces negative effects. We certainly have folks report that in our studies. The balance of effects is much more positive than negative, right? Mm-hmm. But we, of course, are asking, are you nauseous? Are you anxious?
Yeah.
Are you feeling restless? And that comes with it. And that's certainly a dose-related effect.
Right.
I also think, if you look at more drug naive folks, typically that work has been done with amphetamine, particularly oral amphetamine, because that's that's safer. And slower acting, and so you can sort of control it. People certainly will have bad reactions to that if they're naive. But most of the folks we're studying through their natural history of drug use have sort of self-selected that effect. They like.
Yeah,
that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and then the dose effect, so that in some cases, it's gonna maybe make that happen. But in general, the doses you're doing, it's to study the effects, positive reactions. And you started to go into some of these myths, which I'm curious because you also hear about cocaine as I think a very racist history with cocaine. Right. But often you hear a lot about it makes you, quote unquote, go crazy or something like that. Yeah, tell us a little bit about that maybe, and then,
So, I want to be clear that, if you use cocaine regularly, if you use very high doses, it can certainly be psychotomimetic, right? It can cause psychosis. The idea that you take cocaine and you become this crazed person who's out there attacking people, right? That's not true. I have given doses of cocaine in our studies to how many people over how many years, and we don't observe that reaction. Mm-hmm. And now the doses that we're giving in the hospital in our studies, of course, are not exactly the doses people are using on the street. But again, that's just not something that's based in reality. And I'm going to use this term not because it's a good term, but because it's the term that has been used in society. The idea that people are smoking crack and there's these crack babies that are going to have deficits for the rest of their life. That is also not true, right? So, there's this sort of racial perception about crack, which is not true. Black people, white people, all sorts of people use crack cocaine. It's not any one race or any one ethnicity or any one type of person. Crack cocaine produces effects just like powder cocaine, right? And we can talk a little bit more about that if you're interested.
Would love to. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the idea that if women who are people who are pregnant use crack, that's not a great idea. Using any drugs when you're pregnant or not, it's not really a great idea, but we know that those children who are exposed in utero may have deficits to start, but they catch up, right? So there's not this sort of permanent damage that is caused by cocaine that we might presume is the case. To go back to sort of this idea about, the racial ethnic undertones around crack, right? Yeah. We know that there were these sentencing disparities for years and years and years from, I think it was the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, I think is the title, something like that. Very, very clear sentencing disparity. So X amount of crack would get you a very, very hefty sentence. Whereas that amount of powdered cocaine, which you could snort or inject, would get you a much lighter sentence, right? And that was very, very racially driven, right? The idea that people of color were using crack and the idea that white people were using powder cocaine.
Yeah.
And there's, it's a favorite paper of mine written by Dorothy Hatsukami and Marion Fishman, published in JAMA in 1996, where they used science. They took the available data about crack cocaine and powder cocaine, including behavioral pharmacology research like I'm doing now, and showed these drugs are equivalent on a weight by weight. You know, they do the same thing. There's no reason for the sentencing disparity.
Wow. Now, yeah.
That was written in 1996, and it took till 2010 for the first sort of Fair Sentencing Act to come through. Barack Obama said that. And there were still sentencing disparities there, right? There's more recently been work around that. And I think that, you know, still on the books, there's those sentencing disparities, but there's a new DOJ rule, as I understand it, that has evened that out, that has basically said, we are not going to charge differently based on weight. That's federal. That's not state.
Right. But, I see.
You know, it's one of my favorite examples of actually using science to affect policy.
Right.
We know behaviorally in people, crack, powder cocaine, so smoked crack, injected cocaine from powder, weight by weight, pretty much going to do the same thing. So there's no reason for the disparity.
Interesting. I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little.
Soapbox. That's a passionate.
No.
This is what we'd like to talk about here.
Right. Yeah.
No, this is a safe space for this conversation. I'm really interested in this. I've thought about this a lot and read a little bit about, you know, some of these. You know, there's been some like big reports that have come out, you know, kind of talking about these issues. And I was wondering if we could dive in for a second a little bit about, you know, some of the differences between, you know, kind of smokable crack cocaine versus powder cocaine. You know, on the whole, right, like they seem very similar. You know, anecdotally, they, you know, people describe some differences in the subjective experience, whether that's about like how long it lasts or the specific types of effects. And I was wondering if maybe we could just talk a little bit about a lot of it is the same, but what parts are different?
Right. So you know, I mean, I think for the listening audience, it's important to understand, right? So when cocaine is produced from the coca plant, right, you wind up with this cocaine alkaloid as a powder, right? Mm-hmm. Very easy to dissolve and inject. You can snort it and you know get effects that way. You can freebase it, but it is very dangerous to do so, and so it's not very commonly used. But what you can do is mix that powder with baking soda, and that's how you get crack, right? And which is just a smokable form of cocaine without the danger of freebasing. So chemically, they're the same drug. It's just crack happens to have, you know, an additive that allows it to be smoked, right? And you have these rocks that you can smoke. You know, a lot of the differences are about route, really more than anything else, right? So if you smoke cocaine as crack, right, you're going to have that sort of same effect that I've described to you, but it's going to be very, very fast. It actually probably is faster onset, and so maybe more pronounced because it is so fast than even intravenous dosing. You know, if you take it intravenously, you know, again, very, very rapid onset, so probably more pronounced, more, you know, greater magnitude effect. But really, to me, a lot of it's about route. You know, if you snort it, you're going to have qualitatively a similar experience. It's just going to be slower. It's going to be lower magnitude because essentially you're getting a lower dose, right? Than if you injected it. If you inject it, you get the whole dose. If you smoke it, you get essentially the whole dose. Yeah. But if you snort it, if you
get it stranded orally, in various places in your body, right? And it also has to go through, partially it goes through your digestive system, partially it goes through the intranasal cavity, right? And so like it has like different components that you lose a bunch, right? Yeah. But I think that's a really important point. And that's a conversation we have a lot about, you know, things like cannabis, or if you talk about like methamphetamine, for instance, they have similar kind of like, which really the root that causes any type of specific differences, and freebase versus crack probably have, from a profile very perspective, similar, right? Very similar.
Aside from you are taking your life in your hands, I think if you're
Freebase famously in the 80s had several kind of incidents where people kind of really hurt themselves as a function of that, right? And also, you know, powder cocaine is harder to transport and things like that, whereas, you know, crack cocaine is a little bit more stable and you can kind of
it's little rocks, right?
Yeah, it's little rocks you can hang on to.
And I think another thing I would say about that is, you know, if we're thinking about injection drug use versus versus smoked, you know, what the people that I, you know, and I'm talking with people who have cocaine use disorder, who use cocaine pretty much every day I'm in the office, right? Those are the participants that we're enrolling. They very rarely inject cocaine. They know the cocaine injection comes with a whole host of issues.
Right?
You increase risk of HIV, you increase risk of endocarditis, HCV transmission is greater. They're very smart. They're very knowledgeable about that. They know that, right, that smoking it eliminates a lot of those concerns. It doesn't eliminate HCV. You can transfer HCV from a pipe as well. But so they know, right? Like, I can smoke this, and it's not necessarily a good thing for them, but it is certainly safer. It's almost it's almost harm reduction in a way,
certainly,
relative to injection drug use. And I think that is different than for a lot of the opioids, right? Like, you can't really smoke a pill. Like, you can't smoke.
I mean, you could try.
You can try to smoke fentanyl, but you're probably going to destroy it.
Exactly. You lose a lot, and it's challenging and various factors. And I think this is an important point as a quick aside / soapbox, right? It's like, you know, I talk to people about people who use drugs all the time. And, you know, one of the things I like to tell, make sure that they understand is, like, these are some of the smartest people you'll ever meet. The things that they do, they survive super challenging situations, whether that is through, you know, harm reduction approaches to their own drug use, you know, circumstantial events that kind of are associated with individuals or the places where you use drugs and all that kinds of stuff. And they figure out, you know, that, like, you know, IV drug use as it relates to cocaine can cause overdose pretty quick. You can't pull it back, right? Like, there's no, like, I'm at my limit right here, right? Whereas
there's no naloxone for cocaine.
There's none of that, right?
Yeah,
exactly.
There isn't one, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Not only is there no, you know, overdose reversal, right? But opioids is one of the only ways you can administer it, right? And so there's plenty of other options with no, you know, harm reduction approaches other than changing the route of administration, right? Whereas if you're smoking, right, you can say, oop, there it is, because the onset's so quick. Then you say, that's exactly where I need to be. I could put it down. Whereas once you put it into a vein, right, there's no coming back from that. And it tends to have, you know, due to the heart rate changes that happen pretty swiftly, you know, cause a whole bunch of problems real quick.
I would agree with everything you just said. Yes.
This is a really helpful conversation, I think.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. I don't think people talk enough about it anymore. Like, a lot of the national conversations around these issues are on opioids and opiates, understandably so. But I think, you know, these cocaine has a long and distinguished history in America, and it's still, you know, ongoing. I was wondering maybe if you could talk a little bit about that, about just what are the prevalence rates around cocaine use and cocaine use disorder kind of this day and age.
I studied up on my numbers to be sure I was giving you the most current. So, you know, I think the place we go for this is, right, the National Survey on Drug Use and Health,
certainly,
which I'm presuming the audience knows, but is, you know, an annual household survey of individuals 12 and older. And I think we need to recognize it's only talking to people who are housed, right? So we're not getting people who are housed. We're not getting people who are criminal justice involved. So it's probably an underestimate of drug use in the United States. But with all that said, you know, the 2021 NSDUH, which is the sort of the most current data available, they moved from telling us about current use in terms of, like, past 30 days, which I found sort of more helpful, but I don't run the study, so it's not my decision. They're reporting now sort of past year use for pretty much all drugs. And so the number's right around 5 million people report some type of cocaine use, crack or otherwise, in the past year. If we want to compare numbers, we're talking about 1 million or so people who use heroin in the past year, about, I think, 2.5-3 million who use methamphetamine in the past year. So more than those drugs, but certainly less than cannabis, certainly less than other opioids like fentanyl. Right. And, you know, I never like to get in the sort of, like, oh, cocaine is more important than this drug or less important than that drug based on prevalence. Right. But I do like to give, I mean, we do that as a country, right? You know, I do like to give some perspective.
Sure.
Thinking about cocaine use disorder, again, using NSDUH data, which is an imperfect data set, but it's what we've got to work with. It's about 1.2 million people a year meet cocaine use disorder criteria. Again, if we want to think about heroin, it's about the same number of people. Methamphetamine looks like a little higher. I think that's that we've got a trend of methamphetamine coming on.
Right.
Which is maybe a different conversation for a different day. Maybe we'll talk about it today, but you know, it hovers, you know, despite our best efforts, cocaine use disorder hovers right around those numbers perennially, right? That 1 million people with cocaine use disorder, I've been citing that number I don't know, since 2010, 2015, something like that. It's just, it's that's the number.
Yeah. And it doesn't have much change that it appears to have experienced over, you know, a long time of people studying it and it being recognized as a serious public health concern for decades, basically now. And so I wonder if you could maybe talk a little bit about, you know, what's the type of, you know, substance use disorders kind of have like a collection of symptoms that people experience that tend to kind of unify them regardless of substance, right? They all kind of have a similar like phenomenology, if you will. But what, you know, each of these drugs also has some unique experiences. And so I was wondering maybe if you could talk us through a little bit about the individuals that are experiencing cannabis use disorder, you know, what is their kind of experience in kind of early recovery or trying to make a change?
So we follow those diagnostic criteria, right? I will say, I'll give a shout out to Cassie Bonas. I really like the work she's doing around the heterogeneity of, I know she's running
of alcohol
disorder, but
it applies.
I think it applies to also. So shout out to Cassie on that. We're using those 11 criteria, you know, using more than intended, you know, knowing you've got a problem, continuing to use, craving, those kind of things. One thing that I think is really interesting about cocaine relative to something like opioid use disorder or even alcohol use disorder is the withdrawal piece.
Yeah.
And what I'm going to say is maybe a little controversial, but it's my opinion. And it's based on data that I've seen. My observation is there's not a frank cocaine withdrawal syndrome in the way that there is one for opioid use disorder, for alcohol use disorder, or even for cannabis, right? Like I was a co-author on a paper years ago that Sharon, my postdoctoral mentor, was the lead on, where she actually wanted to understand this, right? And so she gave people, you know, pretty heroic doses of oral cocaine, because you can give cocaine orally and it lasts longer. And then, you know, so for a period of time, I think we're talking like weeks to a month. It's been a while since I've looked at that paper, but then abruptly stopped the cocaine dosing. And, you know, you maybe saw a little bit of withdrawal, like negative mood, feeling sleepy, feeling like you're crashing for a little bit, but nothing like a withdrawal syndrome like we might think about for opioid use disorder or alcohol use disorder. So I think that's one place where cocaine's a little different, is that withdrawal phenomenon is not as well understood. I don't want to say it's non-existent. I don't mean that, but it's just, it's not
no,
a
it's different.
Physical withdrawal like you observe.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. I think when you think about, you know, methamphetamine, for instance, you know, early in my career, I specialized working with kind of like in the early 2000s, late, you know, 2000s, I guess, working with people. I'm from Phoenix, Arizona. And so meth was a big deal. And most of the young people who showed up to treatment centers were, you know, experiencing, you know, meth use disorder or meth related problems, you know, and it's a different experience, right? That like, the types of problems they experienced in those early days of recovery was more like cognitive, due to like lack of sleep and other factors associated with it. And they would describe it as a withdrawal syndrome, but it wasn't like my body physically needs it to make this go away as much as my body is kind of run roughshod now a function of heavy substance use, and the kind of reward centers in my brain have been affected in a meaningful way.
Yeah.
Where dopaminergic functioning and other kind of monoamine centers, like you've talked about, are all disrupted due to chronic drug use. And those things aren't just used for energy and mood. They're used for cognition and body movements and all of this stuff. And so that stuff's all dysregulated early on. And so, you know, but that does produce in them, you know, strong desire to return to use.
Right. Yeah. So I think you describe it, you know, nicely, is that right there. You know, I think, and some of that withdrawal, right? Like again, could just be because they haven't eaten for a couple of days. They haven't slept.
Right.
And so they've just run sort of roughshod. You know, so I think that's one thing that is, you know, sort of signature for cocaine use disorder, or maybe stimulant use disorder in general. Yeah. Right. Another thing that I think about, and I've been doing this for what, 22 years now. And I actually still don't have a great answer about this. And I think the field struggles with it, is sort of the idea of craving. Right. And I don't mean, I think when people with a substance use disorder tell you that they're craving a drug and that's driving their use, I think that is real. What I struggle with is how we as a field measure it, right? So just as an example, right? So I will have somebody in the lab and I give them a dose of cocaine, And maybe their craving goes up, maybe their craving goes down, maybe their craving doesn't change. So it's just highly variable in the individual. They could tell me they're craving cocaine, but then they don't self-administer it when we give them the opportunity to do so. Right. So it's just, but again, I don't think as a phenomenon or as a diagnostic criterion, I think it is worthwhile. I think we as a field, though, really struggle to measure exactly what it is, and that what we're measuring isn't necessarily that thing that somebody with substance use disorder will tell us.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
So, that's such a great point. I think it was really prudent to swap craving into the criteria and remove legal problems for a host of reasons. Yes, just the prevalence rates of people reporting I am experiencing craving and the, you know, problematic nature of the legal consequences.
Absolutely.
Right. I think that was totally warranted. But when I talk to people about craving, which I tend to spend a great deal of time on these days, it seems like, you know, it's multifaceted. Right. Like there's a cognitive component. There's an emotional component. Right. There's like, you know, a physiological component to it. You know, some people report it more like, you know, I'm perseverating on it or thinking about it a great deal. Like I want to, whereas other people kind of talk about it like how you crave cake or something like this. Right. It's more of like a physiological response to your body's the absence of things in your body. Right. You know, if you think about like Baker model, kind of, you know, withdrawal, you know, pre-conscious cues that alert your body that it needs specific chemicals to continue operation the way that it's been used to, right? Like maybe that's what's up, you know, but also other people kind of talk about it more, you know, from an emotional perspective you know, how we're asking, like, are you craving right now? Right. You know, and like where that lives doesn't exactly get, put into the calculus of that straightforward question, are you craving right now?
Right.
Exactly. And so because of, you know, which one of those channels is the signal on, right, their behavior might not match up with their self-report in meaningful ways. And I think we really need to start to, just as a quick soapbox, start to disentangle that experience in a way that allows us to understand on which channel is the signal living, so that we can create much more reliable predictive models to help understand what's going to push a person's individual decision to use around in the early recovery days where risk is the highest for continued use.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think that, and again, craving is certainly not unique to cocaine, but no. I would think that that sort of nature of that, you know, to use your, you know, which part are we talking about, right? Is the cognitive part, is the emotion? I think that's probably a little different for somebody who uses cocaine than for somebody who uses opioids, right?
And certainly, you know, yeah, serious withdrawal syndromes produce a much more reliable craving. So if you think nicotine.
Exactly.
Right. Like everybody with nicotine is like, this is it. It's super reliable predictor. Right. Or like even something like alcohol. Right. Or, you know, something like, you know, opioids, for instance. But when you get into some of these other substances where the withdrawal syndrome is meaningfully different for a host of reasons, it tends to get a little murky.
It does. I completely agree. I don't even know if I answered your question, but hopefully that gives folks a flavor for sort of maybe how
I think it does. I think it does. I think at least it helps us understand a little bit about what we're talking about here. And so I was wondering if maybe we could pivot a little bit to talking a little bit about what's available from a treatment perspective, knowing, you know, that this is a very, you know, significant health problem that has a higher prevalence rate than many things that the national conversation is talking about on a daily basis. Right. You know,
could I ask? Sorry, before we jump into that, can I ask, obviously that's on our outline, so I want to talk about that too. So we often, as a society, think of drugs like cocaine as something that will destroy your life, right? How often do you see that that's the case versus there are a lot of people living their lives as, you know, while also using cocaine?
Right. Well, I see sort of both types of folks, right? So you know, some of our studies, we're running clinical trials, right, where we are only enrolling folks who are treatment seeking, and for those folks, you know,
they're seeking treatment.
They're seeking treatment. Yeah. Cocaine is awful. They want to stop.
Right.
They really are struggling to do so, and we'll get into sort of what treatments are available in a little bit. But then I'm also enrolling folks into our human laboratory studies, where again, by definition, those people cannot be seeking treatment because we don't want to give drugs to people who are really trying to stop.
Yeah.
Right. And so those folks, are living with it, right? They recognize it's a problem a lot of the time. They meet these diagnostic criteria, right? You know, some of them severely so, but they, you know, they're not ready to quit, or they don't, you know, they don't want to quit, you know? So I think it's probably a continuum, right? And it probably co-varies with use, and it probably co-varies with life problems, sure. But that's not necessarily the case. I've certainly had young people who have not been using for a very long time say, I'm ready to quit. I don't want to use this anymore. Right.
Yeah.
I don't have a great answer.
Answer.
Cocaine use certainly can cause all sorts of life problems. Some of it's because we criminalize a health problem.
Absolutely.
Right? Some of it's because we are putting people in jail because they've got a health problem. They're using drugs. Right.
Yeah.
Which causes much more harm.
Much more problems.
Right? Absolutely. Absolutely.
But you know, a lot of times that people get involved with the criminal justice system, and then that's a spur for them to quit, right? But not always. I have plenty of people who have all sorts of legal problems who continue to use.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Yeah.
I'm on a soapbox today. I guess this is the soapbox.
No, it's the soapbox day. Yeah. Yeah. No. Well.
That's what this show is for.
It's for research and then research driven soapboxes, right? Yeah. Because I was just thinking in most cases drug. I don't know. From my theoretical perspective, all drug use is functional in some way or another.
Sure.
I was just trying to get a sense for, because I think there is that myth out there that like drug use is a terrible thing for everyone in every occasion that it's
done. Especially certain kinds of drugs, which are socially repulsive.
Right.
Right.
They've created a narrative around it that makes it repulsive. And then therefore it's supposed to be 100% bad 100% of the time.
Right.
Right. Like cocaine,
meth
use, crack, right. Like they all have these like myths that allow us to, as a society to perpetuate these kind of harmful narratives around them. But in fact, many people are able to use cocaine regularly and experience totally livable lives.
The history of it's really interesting. For a long time there was this idea that they that maybe cocaine actually wasn't addictive. I'm using scare quotes here. I know we don't have any visuals here.
Nice.
But right, that people could use cocaine, they could snort it, and it was a party drug, right? But they would not develop a use disorder. That obviously is not true, right?
Yeah.
But there was sort of that idea. I think to the other point is right. If we want to talk about first we know that most drug use is actually polydrug use, right? People are using drug use.
And
in fact, at the end of the day, I think the data suggests that people who use drugs who also smoke cigarettes are probably going to die of tobacco.
Yes.
Induced illness, opioid overdose,
right?
Frank overdose aside, than these other drugs.
Right. Right? Yeah.
It is much more harmful to smoke cigarettes than to use these drugs.
Yeah.
I also want to say, I'm not somebody who said, let's go out and, give people cocaine for free, right?
No, sure. Absolutely. Well, it's just
because it causes plenty of problems, but.
Sure.
I agree that it is demonized in a way that a lot of other things maybe should be. And it doesn't.
It doesn't get the same level of demonization. And a lot of that is, racism and classism that has historically pervaded, American politics and things like this.
Well, and I think understanding like where it actually sits, right? That informs the national discussion, that informs local discussions,
indeed,
policy level decisions that are made about drugs, and it also informs in that, I guess we could talk about treatments in a second, but it also informs when you walk, to start talking to a person, almost always, even if they're treatment seeking, there is some level of ambivalence at some point in time, right? And especially individuals who are, mandated to treatment, and being willing and open to talk about, I think, well, what is this actually doing for you? I think it often helps open the door for conversations. Indeed. It's like, well, and then what is it, how does it take things away from you? And like, is this the balance that you want? Right. So I think thinking of it as all bad actually sort of can sometimes put a barrier between us and the individual that, well, as a therapist,
agreed,
that we're sitting across from, that is, unnecessary, and manufactured by our society.
I completely agree. And again, I'm not a clinician. I have an experimental psychology degree, but whenever I'm talking to our participants doing a consent document, I say, I've been doing this for a long time. I've heard pretty much everything, and I'm never going to judge you for anything you say. right? I want you to be upfront with me. I'm going to be as upfront with you as I can be. And that, you know, I think that creates a really good place for a conversation.
Agreed. Agreed. And understanding it, its continuum of kind of problems to not problems allows us to, I think, push past some of the kind of like created narratives around specific drugs, you know, especially the ones that are like, quote unquote, like hard drugs that like, you know, popular media likes to use that kind of phrase, which makes people not talk about them. Right. You know, whether they show whether they show up for a research protocol or in my, you know, clinical space, they're not going to talk about that because they think any drug use is going to be perceived as bad, when the spectrum here, I think, is much wider than I think the public discourse around cocaine gives credit.
Anyway, sorry for getting us off on.
No, this is, but I am loving this. This is terrific.
Good. Glad to hear. So yeah. So treatments.
Let's talk about treatment.
Let's talk about treatment
or lack thereof.
That's an important part of this conversation we were hoping to have.
Yes. So I'll start with the bad and then maybe we'll go to the good. Okay.
Sounds reasonable.
So a little bit of history and I love this anecdote is that back in the day, when the powers that be, the national academies, were deciding, okay, we want to develop a medication for a drug use disorder. And it wasn't called that then, of course, addiction, whatever they were calling it. They had to pick one, opioids or cocaine. And they picked heroin, and that's how we wound up with methadone and ultimately buprenorphine. That's where they put their resources. So to this day, not for lack of trying, we do not have an approved medication for cocaine use disorder.
When you say back in the day, Bill, do you know roughly when that was? I'm just curious.
I think we're talking 50s, 60s. I think we're talking about when methadone came online, right?
Wow,
like they made that decision to try to advance a medication. And, you know, I would refer listeners to Nancy Campbell. She's a historian, but she's done really nice historical work around the development of substance use disorder treatments. She's done work around the narcotics farm, which I've talked about, but, you know, she's written about this a lot. And that's where I got this anecdote. So I haven't read the original scholarship, but if you read Nancy's work, Nancy Campbell, she was at Rensselaer. I don't know if she's still there. Really fascinating stuff. She's got a book. There was a documentary that came out about some of her work, probably 5-10 years ago. But anyway, awesome. So yeah, I think we're talking 50s, 60s when, again, methadone then came online fairly shortly after, right? Vincent Dole, Marie Nicewander and Mary Jean Krieg did that work in New York. But anyway, so going back then, we were still, the national academies were thinking about a medication for cocaine use disorder. Part of NIDA's sort of founding directive was to develop a medication for cocaine use disorder. And we tried all sorts of drugs. And, you know, I'll maybe get into why I think things haven't advanced in a little bit. But, you know, nothing that we've tried has met with FDA approval. We've got some positive signals. You know, I think that the literature tells us that agonist treatment, particularly using D-amphetamine, reduces cocaine intake reliably, and it can be administered safely. You know, I think a lot of people say you're going to give somebody amphetamine who's using cocaine, right? What we actually see, and we've got preclinical, human laboratory, and clinical trial data to back this up, this is a phenomenon that is real. You treat an organism with D-amphetamine, you reduce cocaine intake.
Yeah,
it's one of the most reliable things we've found, and it's safe. When we, you know, just as an example, out of our lab, Josh Lyle, who's a close colleague and friend, led this study. He maintained people on D-amphetamine, allowed them to self-administer cocaine. We saw reductions in cocaine intake. But on top of that, the pressor effects of cocaine. So I talked about earlier, you know, cocaine increases heart rate and blood pressure. When you treat people with D-amphetamine, you actually blunt that effect. There's tolerance there. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's actually, you know, I think people worry, you know, somebody's going to have a stroke because you're combining stimulants. But chronic D-amphetamine treatment at the right dose can actually blunt that stimulant response.
That's a positive tolerance effect,
And I'm obviously biased. I actually think that we need to think about advancing agonist treatment for stimulant use disorder.
Yeah,
I completely agree.
I don't think that's going to happen. I can give you my unvarnished opinion about that in a second. But the point is, we've tried a lot of things. Nothing's advanced. I wrote a review, I don't know, 6 years ago now, and we tried like 60 medications in 100 trials and nothing has been approved.
Jeez.
So that's the bad. The good is that we actually have behavioral interventions that work, right?
Indeed.
Contingency management works like a dream.
Love
right?
It.
Cognitive behavioral therapy works. Now, like I think it's really interesting when somebody's getting that CBT, it isn't a very pronounced effect, but there's like this sleeper effect that after they finish that CBT sort of module or treatment, that's when their cocaine use is reduced. So I love the idea of sort of CM during contingency management during that CBT to sort of help them achieve abstinence. And then that CBT sleeper effect, that's the sort of ideal prescription, right?
Awesome.
Now, it's hard to implement contingency management because we've got sort of federal statutes that say you can't give kickbacks, right? Which I understand why there's anti-kickback statutes, but we're making progress there, right? Like the Biden administration has said, we want to see contingency management applied for stimulant use disorder.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of policy that has to go along with that to make it happen. But California is working
on it. Yes, they did.
There
That's
are wonderful. Companies who are getting Medicare and Medicaid waivers to be able to do this work. So we really are on the cusp of actually having a behavioral intervention that we can deploy. I think Kathy Carroll's work around computerized CBT is getting us there. So, so that's the good, right? We've got these behavioral interventions that we know work and that we're figuring out how to deploy to people. Because right now, otherwise we got nothing, right? We've got opioid use disorder treatments. We've got smoking cessation treatments. We've got alcohol use disorder treatments, you know, sort of these pharmacotherapies. Somebody comes into your, you know, to a clinic and says, I want to stop using cocaine. Yeah, a physician can write something off label, but there aren't medications.
Yeah. So. Do you happen to know offhand, like the, cause I know we didn't talk about this before. Sorry again,
That's okay.
But, like how many people with cocaine use disorder actually seek treatment?
I think my answer, not to be flippant, is not enough. Right. Like,
right.
or, well, that's actually maybe putting my lens on it. I would say instead that people who want treatment, there's not enough slots available for it.
Right. Well, that's true across the board. Yeah.
Yeah. That's true across the board. Right. Like, so, I mean, I think, as I've sort of moved along in my career, I've realized it's not my job to tell somebody whether they need to seek treatment or not. Right. Like, you know, if they want it, then I want to help them access it.
Absolutely.
But it's not my place to say, I think you need to stop. Right. Like you're in my lab. I know you've got problems. You're in our lab. I know you've got problems. Probably is a good idea for them to seek treatment, but it's not my job. And if they aren't interested in it, right, we can have that initial conversation, but if they're really not interested in it, it's not my job to push it. Right. So, you know, I mean, I think there are plenty of people who could probably use treatment who can't access it. But you know, I think the bottom line is that people who want treatment can't get it. That's the bigger problem.
That's a problem across the board, I think, with substance use disorders. And then also specifically with cocaine and other stimulant use disorder. Exactly. More broadly.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think that, right, like there's a host of just like perceptual issues around stigma and things like this, but also just like, I think professional like confidence in being able to like treat it or deliver something, you know, evidence-based to it.
I think an important point is, you know, so many, and again, not a clinical or counseling psychologist, not a provider here, but my perception is that so many graduate psychology programs do not touch treatment for substance use disorders.
There's empirical literature to support that.
I remember in my cohort, right, you know, so I'm an experimental student, but we've got a clinical cohort at the same time right beside us. I don't think they were getting substance use disorder, or if they were, it was very limited, right? And so they go out in the world and they aren't confident doing that work. And I can understand why. It's not no fault to them.
Yeah, that's been a problem historically for a while, right? It's like, refer.
Well, and it's the problem of just the siloed, like, you know,
and
a lot of like, you know, training and medical and I guess, you know, in the real world. Yeah, it's just like, oh, this is a substance clinic, and then this is an anxiety clinic, right? And so that I think limits people because they're like, well, I'm an anxiety person, right? But really, the person who doesn't have a comorbidity is an anomaly or
anomaly,
not
right?
or it doesn't exist. Yeah. So
they're the rarity for sure.
Well, Bill, we've had so many interesting conversations. I would love to actually continue. Before we move to the take homes, just one quick question is like, what do you think it still needs to be understood about cocaine and cocaine use disorder in order to sort of start maybe hopefully making an impact on that prevalence rate?
So, I think this is true for the field, but I think it's especially true for cocaine use disorder. Something I'm thinking a lot about lately is the idea of abstinence and non-abstinence, right? I think that we as a field tell people the only success is quitting and quitting completely. And if you fail at that, we're going to kick you out of treatment and good luck, right? We don't do that with any other substance. We don't do that with substance. We don't do that with any other
mental health.
Like, So like if somebody has depression and they have a bad day, we don't cut them off.
You don't say,
you don't send them to jail.
If somebody has diabetes and their A1C goes up, we don't stop giving them insulin. But somebody comes into a clinic, right? And they have used a drug that they shouldn't be using. Again, I'm using scare quotes here, right? We cut them off from treatment. So I'm thinking a lot about, and I'm inspired by the work around sort of heavy drinking days and alcohol use disorder. So, but I've been thinking a lot about, right, what does treatment success actually mean? Have we actually asked the people who are affected by this? Right? FDA is starting to think about this, right? They had a listening session called The Voice of the Patient where, you know, I attended that, you know, maybe people wanted to stop, but they cared a lot more about sleeping better and getting better relations with their family. And so I think what we need to do, and I think this speaks to the failure of medications. There are other reasons why I think medications have failed, but I think the failure of medications is that the bar we expect from them, 3 weeks of continuous abstinence, no drug use, it is astonishingly high for a chronic relapsing disorder. And so I think that we as a field, and I'm doing this work, so I'm biased, you know, we're finishing up a clinical trial right now where we're looking at non-abstinence outcomes and cocaine
Love
use.
Love that.
I think we need to be really thinking as a field, right? Like, is abstinence the only thing, right? And if it is, why?
Yeah.
But also, what other outcomes could be, right? Is reduced drug use, right? Again, I loved Kathy Carroll's work before she passed. Brian Killick is carrying that now, right? Like, what level of reduction? I think Corey Ruse was doing that, some of that.
Corey.
Too. Yep. I know you guys know Corey.
Katie Wickowitz has done some work in this space.
Katie Wickowitz
has
done it, right? Like, what level of reduction do we need to see, right? But also, forget reduction. Like, can people continue to use, but they have a goal of getting their kids
right? Yeah.
I think that's what we need to be doing if we really want to have an impact. And so I'm thinking about that a lot lately, but it goes for all drugs, right? Especially for cocaine, especially for methamphetamine. What is that non-abstinence outcome that we really can use to advance as a treatment indicator?
I completely agree with that. And I'm glad you brought it up. I think that's been holding us back as a field for so long, but from a behavioral perspective, but the FDA gold standard for what's considered for a medication and the lack of flexibility or change on that, despite mounting evidence to the contrary, I think is just, you know, absolutely something we have to continue to talk about. And I'm so glad that you brought it up. And, you know, if you think about the spectrum of possible outcomes, right? Like, abstinence lives on one end of it.
Right.
And on the other end is something like use.
Yeah.
But in ways where your life is still the one you want to live.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
And that there's all kinds of stuff in between, and we're missing so much, and we're also missing so much of what our clients are telling us.
Yeah.
That's what they're many of them are talking about that, especially when I specialize in working with young people, and they're like, abstinence, get out of here. I'm not interested. Right. I'm like, I'm 17 years old.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be abstinent forever. What are you talking about?
Right. I think we probably need to move on, but I think, right, like the idea of forever, right? Like, that's really a hard thing to face, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
I also can't figure out, like, so where did we figure out abstinence was the goal, right? Is that just some sort of like going back to the idea of AA, NA,
most likely.
Initial work, right? That's where that came from, and that's what we've adopted.
Yeah.
Or I can't find it science based.
It's some morphing of like the moral model and the brain, brain disease, and like it's stay away from it because if you use it, it's uncontrollable. You know, really what it comes down to is sort of our conversation we had earlier, just like the individual is an autonomous being with the right to make choices on their own. And even if it's better for you to not do something, like in terms of your health, it's a valued you know, it's a value judgment for us to say that this is bad for you all around as a person. And it's really a conversation that I think the individual can, you know, or not a conversation, decision that an individual, you know, can make for their own. So I love that you're doing that work. And I'm really excited to hear. It sounds like it's wrapping up. So excited
to
hear about
it. We're planning the call enrollment at the end of the month. We are not going to get the sample size we'd hope. So I'm a little fearful about that, but COVID-19 did that. But we are, I think we're going to wrap enrollment coming up soon and then really dive into data analysis and start sharing those data, regardless of what they show. Right. I think about the amount of data we have and I want to cry because it is the biggest thing I've ever done. And, you know, we're talking 40 to 50 people per group. They come see us 3 days a week for 12 weeks, and we are looking at blood biomarkers and psychosocial outcomes. You know, Justin Strickland was in the lab while we were running this, so we've got some behavioral economics stuff going on.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's daunting to think about. I actually was like, oh, you know, the hardest part isn't even over, right? Running the trial is not the hardest part, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like every work creates more work, right? Yeah.
We're excited to get those data out there. And, you know, I would say anybody who's listening, I'm a super collaborative person. If people have an interest in this, let's sit down and talk about whether I've got some data that we can work on together, because I truly don't know what we're going to do with all this data.
a lot of options. Yeah. I just actually took a picture of us doing this, and I'm about to send it to Justin. You mentioned his name. So, Bill, thank you so much for all of this. This has been really, really enlightening. And so we sort of have this lightning round, quick questions to summarize if we can. I, neither of us are short-winded, so we try to
ask. I'm not either.
You know, it's fun to talk, so I enjoy. So we'll go ahead and get started. So what do you think the take-home message from some of what you've discussed today is for people who are in recovery?
I think that the idea is that recovery is what it means to you, right? You know, that it's not my job to define recovery for you. You need to figure out what recovery is for yourself. And recovery from cocaine could be anything. It could be abstinence. It could be continued use, but, you know, improving your life. And I think that there's hope, right? Like that if you want to recover and you aren't where you want to be, like there's hope. Cocaine isn't this magical thing that, you know, you're never going to be able to get away from. There are things that you can do. Behavioral interventions you can access that can help you, you know, meet whatever your definition of recovery is.
What would you say to practitioners who are listening?
Oh, goodness. you know, try to use the evidence-based treatments that are available, but I know that those are really hard to access. So, you know, do your best and ask about cocaine use and ask what your patients need.
What would you say to policymakers?
Let us use contingency management and bill for it.
couldn't have said it better. What do you think a take-home message is for some underserved populations as it relates to this?
Oh, goodness. I'd go back to the idea that there's a lot of racial and ethnic bias around sort of the myths of cocaine use. And that, you know, I hope that they understand that we as a field get that now. And that we're doing everything we can to sort of, and I hate using sort of war and combat language, but I think here it's appropriate to combat that perception, that understanding, and recognizing that cocaine is a drug that can cause a use disorder, and it targets everybody equally. And we recognize that it isn't simply a racial or ethnic sort of bias, and that that's more applied by society, by criminal justice. But that we as a field know that that's not true.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really important point, Bill. And thank you for being such an excellent scientist and advocate. You said you were on the Hill earlier this week. You're in a lot of different, you're playing the role in a lot of different ways and making a huge impact. And so we really appreciate that. And a lot of people out there who are struggling with cocaine use disorder and a lot of other drugs, they don't even know how much you're doing for them. And so thank you for that work, Bill. One last question. You've been incredibly successful. You know, you've been one of my research icons from my early days as a wee master's student, actually. And I'm wondering if you could give some advice to trainees out there.
Thank you again for saying that. You know, I've been incredibly lucky in my career, right? And that's not to say that, you know, you don't work hard, but like, I've found myself in the right places with the right people who've given me a shot. And, you know, that's what I try to do, is I try to pay that forward, right? Give those opportunities, speak people's names when I'm able to, let, you know, I've built this network that I'm so proud of, and let everybody who wants to access it have access to it. Right? But, you know, I think this is a Twitter quote. So I think most of us have heard it, but it struck a note. I went to try to find this account again, and it's been suspended, so I don't really know. But Galloway is who it's attributable to, It's that in academia, the idea is that we're all smart. That's true. We're all smart, but you can distinguish yourself by being kind. And that's something that I think is just critical, right? Not everybody is kind. I wish everybody were, but not everybody is. And so to me, that's the most important thing. Yeah, you're smart. You absolutely are smart. You're smart enough absolutely to do this work if you're a trainee, right? Just keep at it. It's hard. I get it. But be nice and be kind. That's what I try to live by every day. Now, I don't succeed at it every day, but I really try to be as kind as I can be with everyone I interact with. So that's my number one piece of advice. Another thing is, you know, try to find what you love. This is a job, yes it is, but to me it's almost a calling, right? I'm so lucky that I wound up in it, right? Like, again, I was going to be a lawyer because I didn't know what else to do. And I happened to, you know, just fall backwards into this psychology major and these classes. And I know that this is where I'm meant to be and what I'm meant to be doing. So, you know, try to, you know, and that's not to say you're going to love every minute. That's impossible. But, you know, try to find and do what you love.
Yeah. Absolutely. Your kindness and your passion, it comes across. We can feel it, and the field's better for it, Bill.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. That's really nice of you to say. And you know, I'm happy to be here, and I'm grateful to have this chance with the two of you to talk.
Well, it's been our absolute pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for carving a little time out for us and our listeners. And you know, we look forward to chatting more about these issues as they begin to kind of pervade the national conversation even more.
I hope they do. Yep.
Next time on the Addiction Psychologist podcast, we're going to have one of my favorite people in the business on, Dr. Sam Mizell. Sam is a research scientist at Bradley Hospital and the Center for Alcohol and Addiction Studies at Brown University School of Public Health. And he's going to join us to talk about interpersonal processes that contribute to adolescent substance use. Don't want to miss this episode.